Be seated.
Our next case is 12-2003, State of Ohio versus Zachary Bondurant and Jeffrey Stevens. For the appellant, Mr. Hicks.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to reserve about 3 minutes.
Okay, can you speak into the microphone, please?
Yes, I would like to reserve about 3 minutes. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Your Honor, this case really comes down to how do we interpret an ambiguous statute? And both the trial court and the Fourth District agreed it was ambiguous. And when you look at 2901.04a, we're told that when a criminal statute is ambiguous, the proper way to interpret it, even when trying to discern what the legislative intent is we're supposed to interpret it in favor of the defendant as opposed to in favor of the state, assuming that there are two reasonable interpretations. And in this case, that's exactly what we have. We have two reasonable interpretations as to how the statute should be interpreted. And in both at the trial court level and at the Fourth District, everybody agreed with that. Nobody ever said your interpretation is unreasonable. Instead, we jumped to, well, we agree with you it's ambiguous. We agree that there's an interpretation that would favor the defendant, but we're not going to interpret it that way. And we're going to go with rather the state's interpretation. And I think that that's clearly against the statute. And the interpretation that would favor the defendant is that the defendant himself has to have had a threshold level of $500 of activity. And in this case, Mr. Stevens, on two dates, had five sales of drugs totaling, the testimony was either $243 or $244. There was a wobble on whether it was $33 or $34.
So then what could he have been convicted of?
He could have been convicted of possession. He could have been convicted of sale. But not the RICO. And so he would have been guilty of F5 level offenses. But he would not have been guilty of what he ended up with, which was the F1 RICO.
What happens if there's a conspiracy to rob a bank and they go in and there's three members and they walk out with $10,000 and only one person is holding the $10,000?
Well, I think case law is already clear under Ohio that if my job is I'm sitting in the getaway car, the proceeds can be, I'm still active, I'm still participating in there. In this instance, you don't have participation beyond these few sales, and then we're extrapolating, and I think it's important that we go back to the record. Mr. Bondurant, money from his sales was found in the large stash of cash. No money from Mr. Stevens was found. It was just these isolated incidents and acts which were alleged because there was this link.
There were a group of people who were linked by the common activity of dealing drugs, correct?
Yes. There were people that were selling drugs.
And this was a group that were linked to one another.
Well, I would say that they were...
They were associates.
I wouldn't necessarily know that they were associates as much as, hey, I need some drugs to sell, okay, or I need some drugs here, and he uses it, or maybe he sells it. But there's not necessarily this agreement that we're in this enterprise together. And I think that's the key factor for this.
Well, I'm going to try and follow the chief's, I'm over here, the chief's analysis. Let's say there's three bank robbers, and there's three tellers, and they go in and they've got this common enterprise, and robber number one, his teller only has $490. And down the line, the other ones have 600, the other one has 1,000. Is that a criminal enterprise that went over $500?
I think if the three of them were in it together, then you could say that they're in an enterprise that's together. And in that instance, I think prosecutors would charge them not with but they wouldn't charge them with they're in a conspiracy. Let me amend that. They're in a conspiracy, but I don't know that they're in a quote an enterprise, unless the enterprise is we're in the business of robbing bank after bank after bank. And
as I understand your appeal, you're saying my cut was not $500, therefore I'm not under RICO.
Well, I think it's even more fundamental than that. I think that there's not enough evidence to show that Mr. Stevens was even aware that there was an enterprise going on, other than that he had drugs that he sold on some occasions and he got the drugs from a particular individual. But there was never
So he was just an independent contractor.
Basically.
And he didn't know that his source had other independent contractors.
Well, I think...
Would that be a fair analysis?
Well, I don't know that it's important whether he knows that there are other independent contractors, because when you're looking at what is a business enterprise, you're dealing with a level of, I'm in this for the purposes of the business enterprise, as opposed to I'm in this for my own purpose. And that's why RICO, the whole Corrupt Practices Act is focused on organized crime, and it flowed originally from our attempts to deal with the mafia at the federal level, and then it kind of trickled down to the states. But if you look at, there's no reason to have a threshold at this point if you're then also recognizing that we're not punishing groups. The organization doesn't go to prison. It's individuals that are punished.
But the organization or the individuals in it are looking at enormous forfeiture problems. That's
potentially other.
That's the big hammer of RICO is the forfeiture.
But in this case, the hammer was you're a small time, 2-day guy that sold $240. Oh well, we're going to nail you with an F1, as opposed to the F5, which is really what the statute intends. When I go back to, and you look at this statute. Yes, you can read it that the way the state argues. And I'm not going to dispute that that's a reasonable interpretation. But you can also read it that it centers on the individual's activity. And I think that makes more sense, because if we're going to put the hammer of RICO on and escalate from an F5 to an F1, it makes more sense to say, we want to make certain that you as an individual are actually, there's a nexus of enough connectivity, enough action, enough commitment to this enterprise. And what the General Assembly has done is they've said, we're going to put a size limit.
Well, what was the evidence in terms of your client's source of the drugs? Was it the same source every time, or was it he was shopping around for the best deal on wholesale?
I don't believe...
He's the retailer, right?
I don't believe the record reflected where the drugs came from on each occasion. There was evidence that it came from one of the people who was, for lack of the better term, the kingpin, but the record did not establish that each and every one of the drugs for each sale came from that source.
But wouldn't you agree if your guy's just helping him, I assume he's consuming and supporting his habit by selling some of the stuff he's acquired.
I think that's a reasonable,
and
yes.
If he's going back to the same source over and over again, then that's two people engaged in this conduct, and isn't that what's required for RICO, is more than one? I mean, he doesn't get RICO if he went out and cut the marijuana out as that somebody planted in a cornfield.
Well,
or that he planted in a cornfield.
Of course, if he had produced the drugs himself and marketed and distributed it himself, that, you know, obviously there's not a RICO. But in this instance, I think when you look at the Corrupt Practices Act, I think that what's the more reasonable interpretation is that there has to be a level of commitment on the part of the individual to get to there. And we're not, like I said, we're not punishing the group, we're punishing the individual.
Well, and now, what level of proof then would you require to ever have RICO? You're going to have tape recorded conversations
I think that,
showing that they've got a business plan of that?
Your Honor, I do a number of criminal defense work, and as you are well aware, the vast majority of criminal defense work in this state flows from drug work. And the reality is it's exceedingly rare to get an individual who's selling drugs who doesn't take a lot of activity to get to $500. Now, it takes more than what he did. And that's my point.
So to avoid the Corrupt Practices Act, every drug seller will stop at $490 and then never be subject to that?
Well, I don't think...
Go and empty out his pockets or whatever and then come back and sell another $490? Is that the idea?
I don't think that that's a viable business model. And the reality is people who are in the business of trying to push drugs.
Why do you think this man wasn't involved in the business of selling drugs if he made a number of different sales and always went to the same source to?
Again, I don't think the record establishes that it was all the same source.
All right.
And secondly, it was on 2 days.
Okay.
It was on one day he sold twice, and on another day I think he sold 3 times. So you're not talking a large level of activity. And what I would suggest, the analogy
there's not talking a large level of activity because he was caught. He wasn't successful, and he should be rewarded because I didn't get a chance to sell more drugs?
No, and that's, Your Honor, I'm glad you said that because here's the thing. The state put this investigation on over a very long number of months. This was not like it was Saturday of today and next Saturday. This was months apart. And over a period of months, they put together various activities. And so in all of this time, the only evidence they have of my guy is on these two occasions. And so
When were those two occasions in the continuum of the surveillance?
I believe one was, and I apologize, I can't quote, one was in October, and then one was in, his stuff was in October, but the surveillance on Mr. Bondurant went, I believe the overall conspiracy went into February or March of the next year. I can't quote that, but I know it was at least 5 or 6 months that they investigated it.
Isn't that what the Court of Appeals was troubled by, though? Court of Appeals said the focus of the statute is prohibiting group conduct. So if you're saying it went over several months, it's fine. Doesn't the General Assembly have the right to say, look, here's the bottom line. If you're doing a couple sales, you're probably not in RICO. But if you go over $500 as a group, you're in.
And I think if that's what the General Assembly intended, then they wrote it poorly.
And they what?
They wrote it poorly. Because
talk to us about that then.
Because I think that when you read the statute, and you're going to hear another argument, which argues a grammatical argument completely opposite of mine, but I think when you read the statute, it's not clear. And the Fourth District agreed it was ambiguous. And so
we're not bound by that.
I understand.
We can take a look at it and say, this is not ambiguous, and it means that you have to, collectively, the enterprise has to only exceed $500, and whether you're a kingpin or whether you're one of the low-level distributors, you all have a role to play in order for this enterprise to be successful.
And yes, of course, you're not bound by the Fourth District. What I would say, however, is that my argument that I've presented is reasonable. It's not out of left field and completely crazy. And when you look at a criminal statute, and you say, look, you could interpret it this way, you could interpret it this way, both are reasonable, this one favors the defendant, this one favors the state, we have a system for a reason to say, in those cases, it has to favor the defendant. Now, if the General Assembly doesn't like that, there's a simple fix. They can come back in the next session, and they can pass a law that says, you know what, we can't believe that the court system said that, but we're going to make clear that it doesn't happen again.
So your position, so I understand it, is that for someone to come under the RICO statute, their portion of the enterprise must generate more than $500.
That is my position, and what I would say, the analogy that I thought of is, you know, I take my kids fishing. You can catch as many fish as you want, but there's size limits. And some of them, okay, it's not big enough, I got to throw it back. And what I would say is the General simply said the throwback limit on an individual is $500.
Mr. Hicks, if you could spend just a moment talking about your second proposition. That these were, he was convicted of the 16 counts, and they were all F5s. And so that means, at the very least, no matter what other arguments may be successful, it should be an F2 instead of an F1. Can you talk about that for just a second?
Well, I think if you look at the statute, it suffers from the same ambiguity because it says predicate acts. Well, we're arguing that the predicate acts are of the defendant, and the evidence that was introduced was not of the requisite level unless you adopt the position that, again, it's all about the group. And I think it's about the individual. My time is finished, according to my clock here.
You can, if you're finished answering
your question. I think I've answered your question, that I think that it's the same problem of ambiguity. And at that point, you look at it and you say, okay, if you look at the individual's predicate acts, he never rose to that level. And so then you look at the sentencing statute and it should be an F2, not an F1.
So the key is whether your arguments on these statutes are reasonable. Because you're saying the rule of lenity would say if you've presented a reasonable argument for these statutes, then we have to follow the rule that says the defendant wins.
Yes, and I'd hate to see a decision that says I'm unreasonable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it Ms. Collins?
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'm Annika Collins. I'm the Highland County Prosecutor. With me at the table is my Assistant Prosecutor, Molly Bullock. A few things I want to address, first of all, is I agree that 290104 dictates that a court strictly construe criminal statutes against the state. However, there is a big however here. As Justice Lundberg Stratton pointed out in State v. White, statutes should not be given artificially narrow interpretation that would defeat the legislative intent, and that's very, very important in this case. As the Court of Appeals pointed out, as the trial court pointed out, as I pointed out in my argument in both, the legislative intent here was to do exactly the opposite of what Mr. Hicks just said with his fishing analogy. And it's convenient he used the fishing analogy because the RICO statute and the engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity statute was designed to net even the smallest fish in the sea, the smallest actor in the enterprise, everyone, even Jeffrey Stevens, who actually had involvement in 5 sales, October 15th, 17th, 19th, and 20th. But above and beyond that, Jeffrey Stevens was actually found by the trial court after hearing all the evidence, and unfortunately Mr. Hicks didn't have the benefit of this, but we had a 3-by-3-foot board that showed everyone, how everyone was connected in the enterprise.
What was the connection of Mr. Stevens to the enterprise?
Absolutely, that's what I'm about to address. Mr. Stevens and Roger Castle are longtime known associates, long before August of 2010.
And who? Castle?
Roger Castle, he would be what the kingpin. Longtime associates back long before August of 2010 when this started. Mr. Stevens became part of the investigation in August of 2010 because he had just...
What does the term longtime associates mean specifically in this case?
I believe there is evidence that they'd known each other since high school.
So if you went to high school together and you lived in the same town, you're longtime associates.
No.
And maybe drank beer together.
Well, maybe, but there was a lot more to it than that.
What I'm trying to get to is something other than guilt by association.
Absolutely.
Can you detail for me what evidence there is in the record that connects Mr. Stevens to the criminal enterprise?
Megan Butcher and Melinda Stewart are sisters in this case. There are 9 people altogether in this case, and they're very close-knit. Megan Butcher and Melinda Stewart are sisters. Melinda Stewart and Jeffrey Stevens are boyfriend and girlfriend. Roger Castle and Megan Butcher are boyfriend and girlfriend. They end up having a child together. During the course of this, the evidence was that at one point Melinda Stewart gave Jeffrey Stevens $3,500. Both Megan Butcher and Melinda Stewart, as well as other members of the enterprise, testified that Roger Castle provided Jeffrey Stevens with narcotics that he then dispersed to other people to traffic. He provided him with money. Jeffrey Stevens brought money back to Roger Castle after he dispersed narcotics.
There's testimony to this.
Absolutely,
effect.
Absolutely. Megan Butcher, Melinda Stewart both testified of this. They all lived together. There will be further testimony that Brittany Finnegan, who is the undercover informant, she's actually the person that bought drugs from Jeffrey Stevens and Richard Rickman, who was tied with Jeffrey Stevens. She worked for law enforcement, did controlled buys, recorded controlled buys. She went to Megan Butcher's house, Melinda and Megan's house, where Jeffrey was living with Roger Castle and bought drugs from them at that house. It'll go further and say Roger Castle ends up getting arrested, and Jeffrey Stevens calls Melinda Stewart and says, you and Megan get to Dayton right away, go into his apartment up there. Roger had another apartment in Dayton where they held a lot of drugs. Get up there. Jeffrey orders those two girls, get up there, get those drugs out of that house and get them back down here so we can disperse them. They go up, they pick them up, they bring them back down. At that point, they give about an ounce to Zachary Bondurant, the co-defendant in this case. So there is quite a bit of testimony, not just...
But counsel, isn't there an argument being made here today that may make some sense, is that RICO is a good statute, everybody wants this criminal activity stopped, but before you get a young man or woman under the RICO statute, that the legislature intended that their part of the enterprise be $500. In other words, not be going after kids who just did a sale, say for 12. What if a kid did a sale for $25 and the enterprise was a big time enterprise? Is he part of RICO?
Well, he didn't do two transactions, first of all. But if he goes back and does another, and he's aware, as Jeffrey Stevens was aware, I think absolutely they should be held accountable. That is what the
legislature... I understand, but I'm asking you to breathe life into what the General Assembly said is $500. Isn't an argument to be made that before you hit a kid with RICO, he or she has to do $500?
I don't think that's the General Assembly's intent. I think that
Why?
Because the intent of the statute was to get rid of even the smallest fish. As the substantive provisions of the RICO statute apply to insiders and outsiders, those merely associated with an enterprise who participate directly or indirectly in the enterprise's affairs through a pattern of racketeering activity. The government need only prove slight evidence that a particular person was a member of the conspiracy, and a party to the conspiracy need not know the identity or even the number of its confederates. The purpose of the statute was to get that person that only does two or three transactions that's furthering the enterprise.
But counsel, the statute itself doesn't say that each individual needs to, or that an individual does not have to have the $500.
No, I don't.
Participation. And if there's a reasonable way of reading this statute that is favorable to the defendant, we are to construe it in favor of the defendant. And if we're incorrect or the General Assembly has a different purpose, it certainly can straighten it out later on.
I agree that if there are two different readings, the court should read it in favor of the defendant, unless, and this is so important, unless, as this court has held, as Justice Lundberg Stratton stated in State versus White, if unless that interpretation flies in the face of what the legislative intent was.
Where's the language that you're referring to specifically?
State v. White, case 2012.
Oh, no, the language in the statute.
Oh, it's the collect. It's the combination of violations. It's the 29.
How does that refer to an individual?
I don't think it does refer to an individual. That's my argument. It refers to the enterprise. And the enterprise is defined as a group of persons. I don't think that it does refer to an individual. I believe that combination of violations is the enterprise.
So to take your theory forward, and I don't have a position here, a 12-year-old who is given a portion of marijuana, sent over, and he sells it to a schoolmate, has committed an F1?
Well, I doubt it, but does he...
He's part of an enterprise that's making millions.
There has to, that's what I would ask. I would ask, what are the rest of the facts of the case? Because in this case, we have
a
facts
sale.
Much greater than that.
I understand that. I'm trying to get your theory. So a teenager who makes a sale for $12... is part of RICO and has committed an F1.
If the rest of the enterprise has established $500, now $1,000 in activity.
Go with a million. It's okay. I'm good with that. Go with a million.
Then absolutely.
The enterprise made a million.
And he's furthering the advance of the enterprise, absolutely.
Okay.
Counsel, certainly reading the Court of Appeals opinion, Judge Harsha says, well, this is what the General Assembly was trying to attack. How do we know that? Don't we just have to look at the words and decide what's a reasonable interpretation?
Well, I think you know it because you've made those kind of decisions before. You've decided these kind of issues in favor of the engaging statute. In State v. White, you can look at State v. Syford, which is a Third District Court of Appeals case. You can look at federal case law that has, which our statute is largely reflective of. And you can make that decision based on the case law that we've already established.
You know, the problem I have with trying to ferret out or tease out the amount that each member of the enterprise is responsible for contributing to the collective success of the enterprise is that it defeats the concept of a RICO or an enterprise, the intent to have stricter penalties when you are engaging in an activity that takes on a corporate or a business persona. Everybody has a role to play in these organizations. But one thing I am concerned, $500 seems awfully low to be mentioned in a statute that is aimed at drug rings and that sort of thing. What is the rationale, for that?
I'm not sure what the rationale is, but I will advise the court, and I brought this up at the trial court level too. The $500 has been raised now to $1,000 with the passage of House Bill 86. It was raised similarly to every property crime in the Ohio Revised Code. I'm not sure that the $500 has anything to do with drugs at all, but rather refers back in the statute to the property crimes that are listed there, because that's how they would become felonies. Otherwise, theft of something that's $499 prior to September 30th of 2011 would have been a misdemeanor. So the $500 may not have anything to do with drugs at all.
How long was that there? Was it in the original?
I'm not sure. 1985 when it was passed, I'm not sure. But it's there now and has just been raised with the passage of House Bill 86 to 1,000.
So it might be, that number might be tracking something else, and
exactly.
That is the level of
a
break on what's a felony and what
isn't. Absolutely. And I made that argument at the trial court level. Another argument that I made both at the Court of Appeals and I've heard you allude to this morning, Justice O'Connor, is the idea that we reward somebody who keeps track of how much they've made off of their drugs and then they stop selling. That's ridiculous. So now, typically in Highland County, which is a smaller county, about 42,000 people, a tenth of a gram of heroin sells for about $40. So you're looking at 25 drug transactions to get you to your $1,000 threshold. That's ridiculous.
So couldn't you, under those, I'm sorry, I'm over here.
Sorry.
under those circumstances, couldn't the state prove conspiracy?
Absolutely.
But do you think we have conspiracy here? I mean, you've alluded to the $35,000 or $36,000. Were conspiracy, were these defendants indicted on conspiracy charges? Was that an instruction that was given to the jury on convictions for conspiracy?
No, they weren't indicted, and no, it wasn't an instruction given.
So isn't that fatal then? I mean, if what we're talking about is, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is to get to your idea that even the smallest fish, good use of the analogy there, even the smallest fish could be brought into the net, wouldn't you have to, you'd have to still establish by evidence the connection to the rest of the net. And here we only have individuals, they weren't charged with conspiracy.
Well, I believe we did establish the connection to the rest of the net. We put every person engaged in this enterprise took the stand either for the state or for the defense, and we were able to tie them together through things like transfer of money. For example, as Mr. Hicks alluded to, Zachary Bondurant, one of the drug transactions that he was involved in with Joseph Kalman, there was recorded buy money from law enforcement that was found in Roger Castle's vehicle in a storage unit in Clinton County in the trunk of a 2006 Jaguar. These people are connected.
But that gets you to establishing the element that there is an enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. But if what we're looking at is individual charges, a person must commit corrupt activity, you could also be convicted of conspiring mm-hmm. to engage in the activity. And I'm trying to make that distinction between the two. And what the defendant says in the reply brief is, you didn't show conspiracy. You didn't prove conspiracy. You may have met the element of enterprise, but in this case, the evidence didn't show conspiracy, and it didn't go to the jury on the conspiracy question.
Well, I don't think that, I agree that it didn't go to the jury on a conspiracy, but I don't think that we need to do that because we've proven that he is a member of the enterprise.
Then why is conspiring to engage different from just being part of the enterprise?
Because you can actually be convicted of both. They are two separate crimes, separate and apart from one another. In Salinas versus United States, a federal case, they addressed that very issue and said that those are two separate crimes.
Were you going after forfeiture? Was that the reason for the use of RICO instead of conspiracy?
No, not just forfeiture. I mean, we forfeited a farm,
that's what
five or six vehicles, $30,000+ out of the trunk of a car.
A other farm?
Money. Yes, a farm that was, none of these people had jobs. I mean, that was established.
Okay. So what was the haul on the forfeiture?
How much altogether?
Yeah.
Probably $180,000 with the farm and the vehicles and the cash. But beyond that, we wanted to get these people off the streets.
Right.
Counsel, there are other states that have done the little RICOs, as they call them. Has any other state dealt with the same issue of the individual responsibility within the organization?
Only with relation to property crimes. This is truly a case of first impression in that it relates to drug crimes. The only cases that address the monetary amounts that we were able to find, I think, even at the trial court level when this was initially argued, had to do with property crimes, which leads me back to the argument that this $1,000 doesn't have to do with drugs at all.
Counsel, I want to come back to the forfeiture for a minute. It's not in this case, but there's been some national publicity about the abuse in this area. Whose farm was it? Was it the Kingpin's farm?
No, it was...
Was it one of the little fish's farms?
A middleman, so to speak. Maudie Jackson's farm.
Okay, and so what had been his degree of profitability?
Maudie is a female, and essentially they used her home to sort drugs, dispense drugs. She paid. The farm was left to her, but then she paid for everything on it with drug money. She had no employment.
Okay,
they admitted to this.
Are you aware of the recent articles about what's been going on in other parts of the country, particularly in drugs, where people are stopped for a taillight out, and if they have cash or valuable property, it's taken. They're never charged with any crime, but at least down in Texas, there's a whole industry of supporting law enforcement by these what appear to be really improper use of the law.
And perhaps I mean, I have heard about this, and I don't disagree that perhaps that is an improper use of the law, but we don't have that here. We have...
I understand. You've articulated a network of folks.
Right. A lot of money and a lot of drugs. I think that hasn't been stressed nearly enough here. Melinda Stewart and...
But you would agree that if we rule in your favor, that we need to be cautious that we don't facilitate the kind of abuse by what we write that's occurring some other places in the country. I've not heard of it happening in Ohio.
I would hope that prosecutors would just have better sense than to
do counsel,
that.
You don't have to be in a RICO to have your property forfeited.
That's exactly
if
right.
You're being charged with a drug offense.
That's
if
exactly
you're
right.
Using drugs to further to support that property, your automobile, your home, you don't have to have a RICO charge. Let me ask about the conspiracy questioning that went on. It's not, you don't have to, in order to charge the RICO, it's not necessary that there be a conspiracy charge as well.
That's correct.
Conspiracy is almost theoretically embedded in the RICO, in the elements that you have to show for RICO. Is that correct?
Yes.
At least conspiracy between some of the members, not all of them.
Exactly, to further the enterprise. Absolutely, I agree with that. I would also say that they, based on federal case law, they are two separate offenses, or they can also be charged as two separate offenses. A person who may not be charged with substantive crime of engaging in a pattern of crack activity or RICO under the federal statute can be charged with conspiracy to commit that statute. And a person can conspire for a third person to commit this, for a third person to commit the crime. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hicks, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I would simply say that Ohio doesn't have a legislative history, so I have no idea where these statements are coming from about we're trying to catch the smallest fish. Your Honor, I also believe that the testimony is a lot more vague about what Mr. Stevens' actual connection was, and I think that the idea of—
Mr. Stevens ordered the females to go to Dayton to the stash house and withdraw the drugs, or is
I thought that was Bondurant, to be honest.
Pardon me, please?
I didn't think that was Mr. Stevens. I thought that was Mr. Bondurant.
So you're confused as to, or it is confused as to who ordered that, whether it was Stevens or Bondurant.
Correct.
And so we can look in the record and determine
I think that part of the record can
counsel, be. Counsel, the question before us doesn't relate to whether there was an enterprise. Correct. We've got that established, that there was an enterprise.
There clearly was, Mr. Castle clearly was running some kind of an enterprise. I just think that when we—
Are you denying that Stevens was part of the enterprise?
I don't believe he was.
Because the threshold was under 500.
Right.
And he had no other involvement other than that?
There's nothing in the record which would tie him in other than the five sales. And I believe that this legislature, we are not artificially narrowly drawing a line to say this conduct, this level of conduct must rise to this level. It has to rise to $500. And the state was able to easily prove $250. And Chief Justice O'Connor, you said, well, how do we tease it all out? It's very simple. You have drug buys. Drug buys are recorded all the time. They have the money. They have how much was sold, how much was bought. It's not that hard to record $500 if that's where you're really wanting to drive this train.
What happens to the enterprise when the little fish, to use that analogy, are not responsible? And the only person then is the kingpin.
Well, frankly, I think everybody in this enterprise, except for, I know Mr. Stevens didn't rise to the level. I'm not sure about Mr. Bonder, and he may have been a little bit over the $500 threshold, but or a little under. But the reality is that most of these, of the nine, everybody else was clearly in way over that level. The reality is there's a reason why this is a case of first impression, because the facts are fairly unique. It doesn't happen a lot to get to somebody that you're saying, oh, you're part of this enterprise, but you only had this little tiny bit of involvement. I mean, usually if you're involved, you're in.
Isn't that what this business needs, though? Big fish, middle fish, little fish. That's just the way it operates. Not everybody can be the Indian or the chief. There's got to be some Indians.
You don't have to
remember
be
that, everybody.
You don't have to be a You don't have to be a chief to be at $600. You don't have to be a chief to be at $1,000.
Well, okay.
It's hard to keep the Indians on the reservation, now.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.